everybody. Welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Dana Trupiana, and I cover infamous gangsters every week in a true crime-like format. My show, Mob Times, comes out every Tuesday, usually early in the morning, but I would turn my notifications on if I were you if you want to see the episode when it first comes out, but most of the time it's early in the morning on Tuesday. So this episode is a little weird because part 3 and part 4 were originally one episode. It turned out to be like over 2 hours, so I cut it in half and now made it two parts, which is why you're gonna see me in the same necklace, same shirt, same everything. I just didn't want you guys to be like over it at a certain point. I didn't want you to be like, oh, just shut up, because like that's how I get when it's like a really, really long episode of something. So I cut it in half just so that, I don't know, you guys could retain the information. Cutting it in half actually made it a lot more manageable time-wise, and it put me ahead a week, which is always great. I love not worrying that I get an episode done in a week's time. That's always a good thing. I did also want to mention that on last week's episode, I had mentioned that I was in talks with the Cleveland family about going there and doing some interviews and stuff, but it doesn't look like that's gonna happen. Everybody is really busy. I tried my best, but it just couldn't be managed. So it's okay. We're gonna keep on keeping on. I just didn't want you guys expecting that content and then it's not there. We're gonna just work with what we got. We got a lot the last time I went to Cleveland. So we'll just be trucking along our merry little way. So let's do a quick recap. We ended off the last video talking about this being around the time that Carlo Gambino died, which allowed the families to make a few new members. One of the guys that was almost made when the books were unfrozen after a 20-year freeze was Donnie Brasco, who was actually Joe Pistone, an undercover FBI agent. He didn't end up going through with becoming a made guy, but after a 20-year freeze on the books and Carlo Gambino having to die to open them back up, this was not the way that they wanted to start off the practice of making new members. Right around the time that the books were opened up again, one of the guys that were proposed for membership was Donnie Brasco. Brasco, or Joseph Pistone, was an undercover agent who infiltrated the Bonanno family from 1976 to 1981. So he was slipped into the position right around the time that the books just opened up again, around the time that Gambino died. And that shit irritates my very soul. I hate Donnie Brasco. I hate Joseph Pistone. Even though I'm fully convinced that he tried to leave the FBI and go into the mafia, I still hate him. But the fact that he really did want to leave the FBI and go into the mafia, I feel like that tells you something about which of the two is the better organization. Okay, so let's hop back over the Cleveland family and rewind again. It's the late 1940s. A guy named Wilbur Clark is building the Desert Inn Casino in Las Vegas. The thing is, he needs some serious cash to make that happen. Enter the Jewish boys, Maurice Klein, Mo Dalitz, Sammy Tucker. This picture is actually of Mo Dalitz and Sam Tucker. I couldn't find a picture of Sam Tucker by himself, but it's kind of cool to get a picture of the both of them together. Tommy McGidney and Lou Rothkopf. Now, these guys are no strangers to the gambling scene. They own the Beverly Hills Supper Club down in Covington, Kentucky, and they have a lot of other gambling schemes going on. These guys decide that they're going to throw their hats in the ring with Wilbur Clark, and they're going to become partners in crime, literally. Fast forward a little bit, and the Jewish boys turn around and they're like, hey, Cleveland family, we need some muscle for our casino operation. So they end up cutting a deal with Al Polizzi, John King, and Frank Milano. What's the deal? Well, they get a piece of the Desert Inn in exchange for the Cleveland family's protection. As for the percentage, honestly, your guess is as good as mine. We really have no idea what percentage is being paid out, especially because Angelo doesn't even know about this until later, and Angelo's the only one who talked. So we really don't have a good grasp on exactly what the cut was. The Jewish boys also snagged a piece of the Stardust Casino in their Vegas escapades. But the Chicago family also wanted a cut of that. Cue the 1960s, and we've got an official mob sit-down over this, I wouldn't say turf war, but scuffle that's going on over this. The Cleveland family stepped up, and they sided with Chicago. And the Jewish boys ended up having to hand over a piece of their revenue to both Cleveland and Chicago. So let's stop right here and talk for a minute about the Jewish boys. First up, we've got Mo Dalitz. He's boys with Meyer Lansky, and he came up in the Purple Gang. He was a bootlegger right alongside Lansky, and he even attended the famous 1929 Atlantic City Conference. Very similar to the way that Bugsy Siegel had stepped in when a builder had already began building in Vegas, Mo Dalitz stepped in and began building the Desert Inn when the original builder ran out of money. Dalitz had always been really close with the Mayfield Road mob, and the two pooled their money together to get this hotel built. And then they also decided to go in together on building and running the Stardust Resort and Casino. Dalitz himself went in on the Sundance Hotel Casino and the D Las Vegas. So while he's running around with the mafia in a gang called the Jewish Boys, he is also a super legit guy. He definitely had the same amount of respect on his name as Meyer Lansky or Bugsy Siegel. Like, he was viewed as an equal. Due to all the building that he's doing and the philanthropy that he's done, he's given an award from the Anti-Defamation League. And that award was presented by Joan Rivers, who was probably one of the greatest people who ever lived. Like, rest in peace, Joan Rivers was amazing. So the fact that he got an award presented by her, like, he's pretty legit. It was Dalitz that got the syndicate involved in the Mayfield Road mob after he became friends with Frank Milano in 1929. Both of these two are heavily involved in the illegal gambling scene in Cleveland, so it's a given that their paths are going to cross eventually. But it seems like Dalitz was either really smart or really lucky, because he hopped on the MRM bandwagon while the Pirellos were still around. If he had instead decided to go with the Pirellos, his entire story may have ended very differently. When Luciano decided that he was going to take out Maranzano and reform the Italian mafia in America himself, he came to Cleveland and sat down with Frank Milano, Mo Dalitz, Meyer Lansky, Santo Trafficante, and one of Capone's guys. When this plan was okayed within the group, a new organization took root, the National Crime Syndicate. Dalitz started the Cleveland Syndicate with Louis Rothkopf, Maurice Klein, Sam Tucker, Charles Palizzi, and Blackjack McGinty. Charles Palizzi, born Leo Berkowitz, was a Jewish boy whose parents died when he was a really young kid, and he was adopted by the parents of Alfred Palizzi, or Al Palizzi, the last boss of the Cleveland family. Louis Rothkopf grew up in Cleveland, a member of the Cleveland Four, a largely successful group of bootleggers. Rothkopf was charged with contempt when he refused altogether to testify at the Kefauver trials. And he invested in countless gambling clubs and casinos, both legal and not legal, all the way from Cleveland to Vegas. So this boy was all in on illegal gambling and legal gambling. So they have this sit down and they try to hash out who's going to get paid what between the Jewish boys, the Cleveland Mafia, and the Chicago Mafia. Representing the Cleveland crew at this little shindig were heavyweights John Scalish and Jack Licavalli. On Chicago's side, we've got Jackie Cerrone and Tony Accardo. A guy named Ronald Carabia, and I'm not even gonna lie, I was kind of lost on how to pronounce this guy's name. It may be very, very wrong. I said Carabia, but it could be Carabia. I tried my best. I'm very sorry if I butchered that. It could be either one. It could be something completely different. So if I pronounced that very wrong, forgive me. Let me know what the right way to pronounce it is, and I'm sorry. But either way, no matter how you pronounce his name, he played messenger, bringing Cleveland's share of the Stardust and possibly the Desert Inn money back from Vegas. So pretty much, he was the one that went to Vegas, picked up the money that Cleveland was making, and brought it back to Cleveland so those Mafia members didn't have to go to Cleveland themselves. Scalish would then divvy it up among the crew, including King, who was actually John King... Angersola, Polizzi, Brancato, Sosperato, Rockman, DeMarco, and yours truly, Angelo Leonardo. Now, this little deal is pretty sweet for Angelo. You've got Dominic Sosperato and John DeMarco, two of his cousins who each participated in a murder with him to avenge his father. So these guys are ride or die for Angelo. And you've got Rockman, who is family to him. He's married to one of Mary's sisters, Mary Scalish, Angelo Leonardo's wife. So I think that makes them brother-in-laws. So I do know that there's some future beef, but they're family. This is literally family, not just, oh, we're in the Mafia family. This is literally their family. And Polizzi is the leader of the family, and the one that stood up on behalf of Angelo and John DeMarco in front of the commission to defend them and make sure that they didn't get killed. So every single one of these guys are straight up in Leonardo's corner. Like, usually when we're talking about the Mafia, we're talking about a lot of coexisting gangsters. Like, they may be close, they may be friendly, but in Cleveland, the whole Cleveland Mafia is truly a family affair, which makes it a whole lot easier to trust one another. Angelo never got the full scoop that the cash that he was pocketing came straight from the casinos, but he was able to infer it. He assumed that that's where the money that he was getting handed came from. That gravy train kept rolling until Kleinman decided that he was going to retire, and when he retired, the casinos all got sold off. I know in Sugar Wars, Angelo talks about somebody from the Detroit family saying that they were still getting money from the casinos. I'm not really sure what goes on with that, but I know that as far as Angelo goes, he continued to get paid until Kleinman retired, sold the casinos, and then the Cleveland family would stop getting paid for that. But while it was still going on, we had a lot of different sources of income. First off, we have the skim money that's flowing out of the glitzy, glam Las Vegas casinos. We're talking about around $40,000 a month. And then you got the slice of the Youngstown, Ohio rackets that are coming into the Cleveland family. The Cleveland family used to be in control of the Youngstown, Ohio rackets because it's Ohio. It would make sense that Cleveland would control them. But they ended up handing over the reins to the Pittsburgh family, and the Pittsburgh family would make a lion's share of the revenue, but they were also responsible for everything that went on there. They had to supply the guys there. They had to worry about everything, and the Cleveland family didn't, and they still ended up getting 25% of the profits from all of the rackets that were going down in Youngstown. So they didn't make out bad in this little situation. Angelo actually didn't even know that any of these deals were going on until he stepped up as underboss in 1976. So all the way up until then, he has no clue that this is what's going on. The Vegas skim kicked off in the early 1970s, and by 1974, Angelo would start seeing his cut, which was around $1,000 to $1,500 a month. And that would usually go through Rockman, Angelo's brother-in-law. Now remember, I said that the Pittsburgh family had stepped in and taken control of the rackets in Youngstown. Well, they also took control of the rackets in Niles, Ohio as well. Representing the Pittsburgh family in this venture were Jimmy Prado and Joey Naples. And these two guys would actually move to Youngstown, and they would make some serious moves while they were there. Now, a whole beef is about to begin. A whole situation is about to explode. And it all starts off because a man named Traffic Hunt is running for sheriff of Mahoning County. And Ronald Carabia, remember, he's the one that was the runner. He went to Vegas, got the money, brought it back to Cleveland for the family so that they didn't have to go do it. Carabia gets handed $60,000 to go to Trafficant and try to persuade him to play nice. Pretty much look the other way while the Cleveland family operated its business, and when he became sheriff, he would allow them to do whatever they were going to do. So let's just, like, stop right there, because when I saw this, I just kind of glazed over it, and when I see this, I just about fell off of my chair. From my perspective, and anybody that has ever heard about this dude, I bet, just read that sentence as Santo Trafficante is running for sheriff. And I am blown the hell away. Like, what the hell, Santo Trafficante? So I look into it, and don't worry, we don't have a mafia sheriff in Florida. Trafficant is actually James Trafficant Jr., but this sheriff doesn't really seem all that different than Santo Trafficante, honestly. James Trafficant was a politician running on the Democratic ticket in the House of Representatives in Ohio. When he was a kid, he was drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, but he never ended up playing football professionally, instead opting to go the law enforcement route in Youngstown, Ohio. He ran for sheriff in 1981. So Carabia, being the messenger that he is, goes to Trafficant and he talks to him, tells him that this money is coming from both Cleveland and the Pittsburgh families, and they both want him to look the other way. But Trafficant is not about this. He flat out refuses this money. He's like, I don't even want it. He pretty much tells them, like, I'm only dealing with the Cleveland family. I'll only deal with you guys. I am not dealing with the Pittsburgh people, Naples and Prado. Don't send them to talk to me. Don't expect me to look the other way for their crimes. We are not getting on board with the Pittsburgh family. It is me. And it's the Cleveland family, and that's it. I want nothing to do with Naples and Prado. So Carabia takes that message back to Naples and Prado, and those two guys, not really known for taking no for an answer, send Carabia back with a very clear message. I really don't care what you have to say about it. You are going to do the same exact thing for us as you do for the Cleveland family. Or we'll take you out and find somebody else who will. But guess what? Carabia does not deliver the cash. But Carabia doesn't bring the cash back to Naples and Prado when he's turned away by Trafficant. So now Naples and Prado, they send Carabia back with the money. And they're like, tell him to take it and he's going to work with us. And Carabia takes this $60,000 that he was handed to make Trafficant play nice. And he takes that money. And Naples and Prado, they think that Trafficant has gotten his payoff. But Carabia is literally just lining his pockets and never handing it over to anybody. Not back to Naples and Prado, not to Trafficant, where it was initially supposed to be paid to. He just keeps the money. Now, Big Ange, he has monthly meetings with Naples and Prado in Boston Heights, Ohio, so that he can pick up Cleveland's cut of the Youngstown rackets. From, like, gambling and vending machines, all the rackets that go on over there. The Cleveland family ends up making, like, $5,000 to $6,000 a month from the Youngstown rackets. Now, during one of those meetups, Naples and Prado go to Angelo, and they tell him that they're starting to get suspicious about Carabia. They're starting to feel like Trafficant never got his payoff. But it's not really like they can really go to the sheriff themselves and be like, hey, did you take the bribe money? Like, we have no idea if he got paid. Carabia says that he handed the money to Trafficant, but Trafficant is not behaving like somebody who got $60,000 from us. They're starting to feel like, you know, we sent it, but we're having a feeling like you never got it. Did you? But they can't. They can't go to him and ask him that. Just that's how you get arrested. They've got this hunch that Carabia is playing games, keeping that $60,000 for himself. And he's running around saying that he's this big deal. He makes all this money. He has a poker machine empire. And they're thinking that he's just flexing on this $60,000 that they gave him to pay off Trafficant. On top of that, Carabia, he is just a mess. He's out at the bars. He is blabbing, bad-mouthing both the Pittsburgh and the Cleveland families. He's putting all of everybody's business on the streets to anybody who will listen. At the next meetup, Leonardo goes to meet up with Naples and Prado, and he takes Licavalli along with him. Naples and Prado drop a bombshell. They want the green light to take out Charlie Carabia. Now, at this meeting, the Cleveland family, specifically at this meeting, Leonardo and Licavalli, representing the Cleveland family, they don't want this to happen. Why? Well, it turns out Charlie is supporting Ronnie Carabia's family, while Ronnie is doing time for offing Danny Green. We're going to talk about Danny Green, don't worry. We're not going to talk about him right now, but we will talk about him and what happened with him. Leonardo and Licavalli, they want to talk to Charlie. They want to figure out what's going on and why people want to kill him. And they don't want the support of Ronnie Carabia's family to be taken out. And they don't want Charlie Carabia to be taken out over a misunderstanding. So they're like, absolutely not. Do not do anything. Let's get this figured out. Let's work it out. Leonardo takes a trip to Pittsburgh with Pat Ferruccio to pick up a payment for the Youngstown Rackets. They go there to meet up with Gabriel Kelly Manorino, and while they're there, they meet up with the Pittsburgh family boss, John LaRocca. LaRocca makes it clear that he also wants Charlie Carabia to be taken out. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, guys. Like, I'm pronouncing it a million different ways. I don't know what the right way is. It's C-A-R-A-B-B-I-A. I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong. I'm calling it Carabia. It's probably wrong. I looked it up, but I forgot. So we're going with Carabia. So Leonardo, he even tells the Pittsburgh boss, like, no, you are not killing this guy. Leonardo does not want Charlie to die. And he's doing everything he can do and saying everything he can say to try to prevent Charlie from being taken out. But everybody in the Pittsburgh family wants this boy gone. So Leonardo, he goes to Charlie and he tries to work this out. He's trying to settle everything down, and it seems like he got it done. It seems like he got everything handled. He goes to Charlie. Charlie tells him what he tells him. And Leonardo walks away from the meeting feeling like everything got worked out. So at a later meeting at the Holiday Inn in Boston Heights, Licavalli and Big Ange, they go to Prado and Naples and they're like, hey, Charlie is off the hit list. It's an official no. Do not touch him. We talked to him. We worked it out. Everything's good to go. Do not touch him. Now, Prado and Naples, they're pissed off. They want to kill this guy, and they just gotta know. But Leonardo reassures them that if Charlie were to start trouble again, if he were to do absolutely anything wrong, they'll get the green light to take him out. They just don't have it right now. So more than a no, they kind of got like a not right now. Fast forward a bit, and news hits. Charlie Carabia has gone missing. At another meetup, Prado and Naples, they turn around and they tell Big Inge. They took Charlie out because they got wind that he was planning a hit on them. They even apologized for leaving Charlie's car in Cleveland, claiming that the driver had no idea where he was dumping it, and it just so happened to end up in Cleveland on accident. Now, at this point, Big Inge is hissed. He gave a very clear do not touch, no go on the hit. They didn't reach out to him and say, hey, he's planning a hit on us. Can we take him out? They just went ahead and did it, even though they did not have permission. They asked permission, they got a no, and they went ahead and did it anyway. What assholes. So now Ange turns around and he's like, I bet, cool. You guys want to ignore me? Totally cool. I got you. Charlie was supporting Ronnie Carabia's family. Now you get to do that, because I'm not doing that. I told you not to take him out. You decided to do it anyway. That's on you now. Congratulations, you now have a family. It's five boys and a wife, motherfucker. Have fun with that. Also, stay the hell away from Orly Carabia. You try to touch that boy, we're fighting. Like, he pretty much tells them, it will be war if you go near Orly Carabia, which is another brother. So he's pissed as hell that they touched Charlie, but he's not going to war over it. But if they go near Orly, it will be war. On May 26th, 1976, the boss of the family, John Scalish, remember Mary Scalish's brother and the boss for the last 30 years, well, he dies. He died during a heart surgery that he was having at Lakeside Hospital in Cleveland. He had been sick for a really long time. He was in and out of surgery for like 30 years. He had cancer, he had a colostomy, and then it all came down to the wire. He was told that due to cancer, the arteries in his heart had hardened, and he was all but certainly dead. The only shot that he had, and it was a very slim shot, was a bypass. And without it, he would be dead in weeks. So, as a gambling man does, he gambled. He had the bypass surgery, and it was successful. Unfortunately, he died an hour or two after the surgery in the recovery room. Now, remember that these guys are all family. Rockman is Scalish's brother-in-law. And while Scalish was sick, he was spending a lot of time with Rockman. At a meeting in Scalish's house right after Scalish died, Rockman swears that Scalish's dying wish was for Jack Licavalli, aka Jack White, to take the reins and become the new boss of the Cleveland family. Since Rockman was the only one that was with Scalish when he died, they really don't have a choice but to take his word for it. At first, Licavalli is absolutely not having it. He says, absolutely not, I want nothing to do with it. Angelo is like, this is what Scalish wanted, and Licavalli is still like, nope, absolutely not, I'm not going to be the boss, I want no part of it. Absolutely not. So now what happens? Younger members of the family start going to war to take that top spot of boss of the family. With Licavalli denying the seat and no official successor put in place by John Scalish, what ensued was an all-out war for that top position. In the midst of all of this, a war breaks out with Danny Green because he's trying to take control of the rackets that Scalish had. There's war going on all around. People are dying in car bombings left and right. Cleveland has now gotten the moniker Bomb City from the magazines and newspapers. And this may be the worst thing of all. The Cleveland family loses their seat on the commission. With all the infighting going on, as well as the fighting going on with the other gangs in the city, leading to headline-grabbing news stories every other day, the New York families had enough, and they took away Cleveland's seat on the commission. After seeing all the havoc that has taken place, Licavalli eventually steps up, and he takes the position of boss of the family. He really doesn't want it, but he also doesn't want the war that's going on around him, so he's pretty much like, Scalish named me, and if me taking this position means there's no longer going to be a war for that position, I'll do it. When Licavalli eventually steps up and takes position as boss of the family, he names Leo Mochery as his underboss and Tony Del Santer as his consigliere. Now, Licavalli, he's been around for a while. He steps up right now and becomes the boss of the family for the first time because Scalish has been boss for the last 30 years. But he's been in the Cleveland crime scene forever. He is not new blood here. Now, if you speak to Big Ange, he swears that Rockman was lying when he said that Scalish wanted Licavalli to be the boss. According to Big Ange, Rockman thought it would be easier for him to control Licavalli than Big Ange himself, so he just lied and said that it was John Scalish's wishes that Licavalli be made boss. And since nobody was with John Scalish when he died except Rockman, who can really call him out on his bullshit? But according to Big Ange, Rockman's nose grew 3 sizes when he said that. And honestly, I kind of believe Big Ange. Scalish was Big Ange's brother-in-law. They seem to always be really close, and Big Ange is mob royalty. Why would anybody except him be named boss of the family? Why would Scalish not name him as the new boss? He had been tapped for the position forever. He was heir apparent. He was de facto boss. Everybody thought this was going to be his position. And then out of nowhere, Rockman comes along and says, oh no, he really wanted Licavalli. It really just doesn't make any sense. I believe that Big Ange was supposed to take that position. Now, even before being given the position of boss of the family, Licavalli had a lot of power because he inherited a lot of territory, influence, and money when a longtime friend of his, Frank Camerata, had been deported from the U.S. a few years earlier. People believed that Licavalli was a lot closer to the family in Detroit than his own family in Cleveland, especially since the Detroit family was currently being led by Pete Licavalli, who is apparently the acting boss while Yanni Likavalli is serving a life sentence for murder. So the whole Detroit family is all Likavallis. And now the Cleveland family is being put in control of a Likavalli. So everybody always thought that he was way more for Detroit than his own family in Cleveland. So because his friend Camerata gave him everything he had when he was deported, Jack Likavalli currently controls Trumbull, Mahoning, Warren, and Youngstown, Ohio counties, and regularly makes trips to Florida and Hot Springs, Arkansas. For those of you who haven't seen a lot of my episodes, Hot Springs, Arkansas is an area that is very well known for its lawlessness. A lot of mobsters that are on the run from the law, they will go there, and it's pretty rare that they'll get caught. The most famous mobster who's on the front page of every newspaper all over the country could go to Hot Springs and won't be noticed or found for a really long time. So to see a mobster go to Hot Springs for business isn't really all that surprising. Now, Likavalli, he's never been boss before. He has no idea what to do. He's not aware of the protocol. Right there, Angelo tells him, hey, you gotta go to New York. You gotta introduce yourself to Tony Salerno because they represent us on the commission. Tony Salerno is a really big shot within the Genovese family. And remember, because of all the fighting that went on, because Likavalli didn't take the role of boss of the family right away, they lost their position on the commission. They no longer have a seat on the commission. So now it's Tony Salerno that's representing them on the commission. So now Likavalli has to go to New York and introduce himself to Tony Salerno. In 1976, Leo Mochery gets whacked on orders of John Nardi. Once Mochery is out of the picture, Angelo steps up and he is now the underboss of the family. Now, let's talk for a second about Mochery because, yeah, his death allowed Angelo to step into the coveted underboss position. And that's bittersweet because he's convinced that he isn't the full-on boss of the family only because Rockman can't control him. But anyway, he's now the underboss. It's not as good as boss, but it's underboss. Hooray! But who had to die for him to take that title? Leo Lips Mochery was Likavalli's cousin. Now, obviously, with Likavalli as a cousin, he had one foot in organized crime pretty much his entire life. Because it isn't just James that's in that life. Remember, we talked earlier about how James's family is in Detroit, and they're all leading the families over there. Well, that's where Mochery comes from. He came up in Detroit, and he pulled off a bank robbery while he was working as an apple salesman. And that's how he ended up getting into organized crime. Now, guys, this is like the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. He is literally selling apples. Not Apple phones or iPads or anything like that. Literal apples that you bite fruit apples. He's an apple salesman. So Mochery goes, he robs this bank, and he impresses the Detroit Mafia. So once he robs this bank, he gets involved with Yanni Likavalli. And in 1940, he's given the position of consigliere of the Cleveland crime family. He's consigliere under Scalish, but when Scalish died and his cousin James took over as boss of the family, he makes the lateral move to underboss of the family. Mochery was killed on orders of John Nardi on August 22nd, 1976, after a really long, drawn-out battle had ensued the entire summer before Mochery's death. John Nardi had a lot of dreams of being at the top of the family himself. His family comes from really high places as well. His uncle was Anthony Milano, so Frank Milano was his family. So this boy is just as much of mafia royalty as Angelo Linardo is. I wouldn't say just as much because, like, it's his uncle versus his father, but he's pretty evenly keeled. So having these hard-hitting family members made John Nardi feel like he was invincible. He thought that with his years of experience and high-standing family members, he was more than capable of taking on the leadership position. Nardi and Mochery, they never got along. Mochery described Nardi as greedy, overly ambitious, and reckless in both his personal and professional life. Mochiri's biggest problem with Nardi was his close relationship with Danny Green, who the MRM had had problems with for a really long time. This is a really fresh wound, too, because remember, the Cleveland family had just gone to war with Green right after Scalish died, fighting over Scalish's rackets. So this is kind of a double whammy. On top of the friendship with Green, Mochiri refused to kick up any money from gambling games that he had run with Jack White. On August 22, 1976, Mochiri disappeared after enjoying the feast in Little Italy, shortly after having a meeting where he refused Nardi's demand for a cut of his gambling profits. Nobody would ever see him again. His car was found 10 days later, and the trunk of his car was covered in blood, but no body was ever found, and to this day, we have no idea where it is. So now that we have gotten to the point where Angelo is officially the underboss of the Cleveland crime family, I'm gonna go ahead and end here. Thanks so much for watching. Let me know if you made it all the way to the end, because this one, it's not as long as it would have been, but it's still a pretty long episode. So I'm interested to hear how many people actually make it to the end of the episode. It was also jam-packed with information. So if you made it to the end, you're a real one. I hope you enjoyed part four so much that you'll come back next week to hear part five. I don't think it's going to be the last part. I think there's probably going to be six parts, but I don't know. I'll do what I can. There's not going to be seven, so it'll either be five or six. It's a lot to cover, so I don't really know. Please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, comment, follow, do all the things, and I'll see you next week. Bye.